Hey, everybody. Welcome to a very special episode of Forging Worlds. I'm Alan.
And I'm Matt. And today, we're trying something out.
I promise it's not like an after-school special type of special episode, but instead we're answering questions.
Yeah, questions that you, our listeners, sent in, or some of y'all did. And thank you so much to everyone who did send in questions. Y'all made this episode literally possible.
Yep, because otherwise I would have had to like think of questions for Matt, like what is his favorite food? Why is Shaman his favorite Pokemon?
It's a literal hedgehog, Alan. It's a hedgehog. It's a hog made out of a hedge. It's a pun, and it's perfect, and he's my delightful murder ball who will sit on my shoulder and smite you.
So, we are calling this Mastering Your World, and that's the hashtag that we've been asking you to use to send in your questions. Anything really related to RPGs or really anything. And we got some cool responses. Do you want to kick us off with our first question?
So, our first one is from way back in February. Sorry, Corbin. When we first put out any mention of this, we kind of just wanted it to hang out there and kind of gather responses. Yeah, that's the better way to put it. And Corbin was the first one to respond, so we're going to start with his. His question, Alan, is how much divergence from the source material is too much? Like if I run a Legend of Zelda game but set it in a steampunk world, is that too much? What if Ganon, Link, and Zelda aren't the focus at all? What if it's the Matrix, but everyone is the one? Emoji.
Yes, 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 yes. Yes, 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 yes.
I think it is important to preface this by saying Alan occasionally plays in a casual game in a Zelda, Legend of Zelda system made by Nora, which you should absolutely check out. Yeah, it seems like
she's at Neither Nora on Twitter.
Yes. Cast member on Lost Library with Alan and I.
She's an incredible game designer.
Yeah. Go check her stuff out. She's got a Patreon full of it, and I think you can find it on DriveThruRPG now.
I think so.
I think she's releasing it there, too, so that's pretty great. So I know Alan plays in one of these games. He plays an abomination against God and nature.
I think you mean the best... I can't even remember what... Oh, I'm such a bad fan.
Ruto?
Yes, Ruto. I think you mean the best Ruto boy that ever did Ruto, aside from maybe Revali.
So this is very much an inside joke, and I'm sorry that we're doing this to y'all. If you want to know what kind of bird Alan is playing, look up Patoot?
Potu.
Potu.
P-O-T-O-O. The character's name is Potoot.
Okay.
But
it's not a real bird. It's a puppet. And I'm sorry that we're making you look at it.
It's 100% a real bird that likes to pretend it's a sick.
It's a fake bird. It's a puppet, Alan.
With that being said, I think it is always a wonderful idea to take things that you draw inspiration from and then turn them into your own thing. The one caveat I give to that is if you are writing something. So if you are creating a game or if you are writing a module or something like that, you do have to be aware of, you know, copyright and intellectual property and that kind of thing. But if this is a homebrew, you and your friends are going to have fun, absolutely play with the world. Make it fun. Make it different. What if stories are great? I love running, like, what if Marvel stories. There's a Marvel superhero RPG that I particularly like. And doing what if stories in that, having the players pick their favorite superhero and then ask a really dumb question and then go for it. Well, I perceive it to be dumb probably because I ask it. But, you know, do whatever you want with it. That's the beauty of stories, is that you can tell it however you want.
My one cautionary note here, and I don't know, cautionary might be the wrong word. My one note on kind of the other side of the fence here is make sure, especially if you're in one of these well-known worlds, make sure everyone at the table is on board.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're going to do the Matrix, but everyone is the one, maybe check and make sure you don't have like a die-hard Matrix fan who might lose their mind at the idea of there being more than one, the one, running around the world. This is the same kind of cautionary reason why when I run a game of Edge of the Empire, Fantasy Flight's very good Star Wars system, I don't set it anywhere in time near the movies or near really roughly established canon at all. I try to set it like a couple hundred years before the prequels, or maybe in that 10-year gap between one and two, where currently there's not a whole lot of conversation happening in new canon. Just because I know that I still have some lingering bits of old grumpy nerd boy in me that are just like, that's not canon, we can't do that. And that's, one, not a great reaction, and I'm trying to beat it. Two, I can have so much more fun if I'm unrestrained by things that everyone is going to be familiar with. Like in the Legend of Zelda game that we used as an example, the one Alan's playing, none of them play Link or Zelda.
Mm-mm.
And to my knowledge, there's not a Link or Zelda or a Ganon problem. They just run around Hyrule.
Well, we did get our quest from Princess Zelda.
Okay, well, sure. But you're not, like, trying to kill Ganon, right?
That's correct.
Because that's not your job. Like, in that world, unless you change it, that's Link's job. That doesn't mean Ganon's the only evil thing. There's other stuff out there to be dealt with. So, yeah, dude, like, play around with stuff. Unless you're trying to make a buck off of someone else's property, ain't nobody gonna care.
Right, exactly.
And if they do, have a quick and they're at the table with you, have a quick conversation with them before it gets started and be like, okay, how would you like to play this game? Because unless they're just monsters, you're probably going to be able to find a common ground somewhere to have some fun.
Absolutely. And I think that boils down to one of the biggest pieces of playing games like this, where you're kind of shifting and doing things. Communication with your players is really important. For example, if you tell them that they are going to be playing a Matrix game, they will go in with specific expectations. But if you say, hey, we're going to be playing the Matrix, but I'm going to do A, B, C, D, E, then they understand what they're playing, and you run into a lot less of the clash if you're upfront with your players about what is going to be different from the standard version of this story versus your version of this story.
There's actually, and I just kind of got caught up because this is Forging Worlds, this is how my brain works. On that Matrix idea, we know the details of two of the seven iterations of the Matrix. We know the first one was a utopia that we all rejected, and we know the seventh one is the one we see in the movies. My dudes, that leaves five that we don't know jack about.
Mm-hmm.
Go nuts.
Yep.
Like, that's some fertile ground. All right. I think, Alan, it's time to move on to our second question.
So this is a question from Peter Sayaka, and I apologize if I mispronounce that, at Super Sugar Bolt. Hey, guys, I love how much you two reference the awesome Discworld series. What are your favorite, yeah, quote-unquote, sub-series to read, listen to, huh?
I said, heck yeah. Love me some Discworld.
What are your favorite sub-series, quote-unquote, to read, listen to, i.e. Moist Von Lipwig, The City Watch, etc.? Also, what tabletop RPG do you think would best fit a Discworld campaign? I'm going to address the last one first. There actually is a Discworld role-playing game.
What?
Through GURPS.
Oh, never mind. It got bad. Never mind. I'm sorry if you're listening out there and you like GURPS. That thing is crunchier than a mouthful of gravel, and I won't. I'm sorry. I can't. I'm glad they made one, but no thank you. Not GURPS.
So we can kind of jump back to that and talk about more a little bit about how we would run this or where we would set it.
Yeah.
To the former, I'm always a fan of the witches.
Which is pretty great. I love me any story that kind of revolves around Unseen University. the Unseen Academicals, the one that's all about soccer, except not, soccer with a different coat of, with a fantasy coat of paint on it, is, I think, my favorite book that Terry Pratchett ever wrote. It's incredible and great, and somehow manages to talk about all of society while talking about soccer. The man was a genius. Like, someday I hope to write like a tenth as well as he did.
The other thing that I like about Pratchett, I like his books that are seemingly unconnected or that you can read as standalone. Mm-hmm. The one that immediately jumps to my mind is Going Postal.
Heck yeah.
Just because it's nice and refreshing, and if you're familiar with Discworld, you get a lot of the references and things, but it's also a very good jumping on point for someone who's never heard of the series. So you don't necessarily have to start with The Color of Magic, although it is a good place to start because it is an incredible book. But yeah.
Going Postal also has the benefit of, what, like 20, 30 years of Pratchett's writing evolving?
Yes.
It's one of the more modern books. Color of Magic is very fun. Color of Magic is also very much a product of its time.
True.
It is that, like, 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s fantasy. I mean, it's Pratchett, so it's all, like, satire and running up, you know, those traditional fantasy tropes and taking pokes at them, but it is what it is. It's a very good book. Like, you should read it, just know what you're getting into. Mm-hmm. I would start with one of the later ones, honestly. Like, you don't need to know a lot. He explains everything you need to know,
right,
in each book. But yeah, Unseen Academicals, Going Postal, those are all great choices.
As for which RPG, this is kind of a generic choice, simply because I really do think this would work, especially considering Pratchett's proclivity for things happening, even if, like, you're not expecting them to. I would suggest running it in Genesis, simply because instead of the numbers, you get success, failure, advantage, disadvantage, and it's a much more narrative way to tell the story, which I feel would really serve the kind of world that Terry Pratchett built.
Yeah, no, that's a good choice that I had not considered. My choice is along the same lines. It's Fate.
Mm-hmm.
For almost the exact same reasons. Fate has some more numbers behind it than Genesis does, but, you know, still kind of the same deal. It's mostly story-driven. And, like, you could put some really good compels into a Pratchett world.
Oh, for sure.
So, yeah, well, we both love Pratchett unapologetically. Like, I'm looking forward to seeing this Good Omens show or movie or whatever it is they're working on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because the pictures of it so far look incredible. So our next question is from All Star at All Star 20095. This is a little bit of a longer question, so buckle up. Hey, Alan, Matt. So I really like this tabletop RPG called Ironclaw. Its core setting is in the Victorian age, where gunpowder is the new hot thing and royalty is losing its grip. But a lot of people, from what I've seen, are turned off by the game, seeing as it uses anthropomorphic animals as its main species. I personally find it weird that people are turned off by a game setting just because it uses talking, walking animals, but are okay with game settings that use harpies, gnoll, lizard folk, and dragonborn. And they put in parentheses, and I'm not even a furry or anything. So my question to you guys is, do you think this criticism is fair, or is this a blatant case of hypocrisy, or maybe it's something in between? I think it's in between.
I think it's in between, but I lean to hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Because
it's on that side.
Here's the thing. Harpies and Dragonborn and all of that, those are things that have been kind of cemented in fantasy lore for as long as fantasy lore has been fantasy lore.
Yes.
So it's a lot easier for people to look at those things and go, oh, that is a fantasy trope, not, oh, that is something that should not be human made human, i.e. anthropomorphization. when it happens with other animals, especially with the furry culture, some people get skeeved, which I think is really disappointing. One of the most recent books that I've been really interested in is called Pugmire, where it's Dungeons and Dragons, but you play as anthropomorphic dogs. And it's kind of adorable and wonderful, and it's great. I think there is some not necessarily hypocrisy. I don't know if that's the word I want. But it's, I do. Go ahead.
It feels like a taste preference thing. That's how I view it anyways, is I agree with you. Like, this is all of tabletop RPGs is you're playing pretend with some firmer rules and dice. That's all it is. And like, you should feel comfortable enough to do whatever you want to do in that space. Like, with the consideration of everyone else at your gaming table, of course, but you should be able to be who you want to be. I mean, one, that should be true in our real world. But that's a can of worms that we don't have the time or expertise to dig into.
Exactly.
So we kind of have to focus on this one. But I would say it's a taste consideration. Like, it is kind of hypocritical that people are like, I'm going to go be an elf over here. Or nowadays, like, Dragonborn or Tabaxi or Lizardfolk. Like, I'm going to go be this in D&D. But you're going to go be an anthropomorphic fox in the Victorian age of England? It feels like one of those things where cultural concepts have tainted it in ways that maybe it was or wasn't intended. Like, I don't know who wrote Ironclaw. I don't know if they're part of the furry community. I don't know any of this, so I can't speak to that. But let me tell you a true story from Matt when he was a younger, more stupid person. I got invited a long time ago, to play a game of Vampire the Masquerade with some people. I was probably gonna, but plans changed and I ended up not living in that city long enough to really get involved with things. But my first reaction was just, no, I don't LARP. Look at me. Do I look like a fucking nerd? I don't LARP. Come on. Which is, one, wildly inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to LARP to play vampire. And two, brother, you best believe right now I would go out to a forest and throw some beanbags at some people pretending to be an elf. Hell yeah. Like, that sounds like just a fun weekend with some hopefully cool people who are on the same wavelength as me. That sounds fine. But it's that idea that this cultural perception where there was, like, nerds, D&D nerds, and then way at the bottom was LARPers. And that association with vampire, because it was a very easy system to LARP with, like, tainted the whole product. And it kind of feels like the same thing. Like, people get all like, oh, furries. Well, I'm not about that life, so I don't want to play your gross furry game. And that's just kind of gross and bad and wrong. And please don't.
I also think there's a certain amount of, like, cultural currency, I guess. When you say that you're playing Dungeons & Dragons, that is a well-known game. It is a mega-million, multi-million dollar enterprise of a game.
Uh-huh.
You know, it is household. It is recognizable. So saying that you are going to be playing an elf or a dragonborn or even a tabaxi in D&D is less... It doesn't make you actually engage your brain as much as going, okay, but what is Ironclaw? Who's her? Like, Ironclaw does not have the same base and it doesn't have the same brand recognition as Dungeons and Dragons. So people, I think, would probably be more, and it's not just an Ironclaw problem, obviously. This is multiple indie RPGs that do things better in most cases than other things do. But people are like, I don't want to mess with that because... You know, I would rather play something I know, or I've never heard of it before, so it can't be good. Like, that kind of stuff. So no, I think yeah, that plays right into it a little bit.
And there's also, like, a little bit of taste or not taste, like personal preference involved in this as well. Like me personally, Matt, this guy, I don't have a desire to play Tabaxi. I don't have a desire to play a Lizardfolk or a Dragonborn. I've played a Dragonborn, but it's not like my go-to. I don't have a personal desire to go play an anthropomorphic animal. That ain't me. I would love to play a game of Pugmire, because here's kind of the conceit of that is something happened and the people went away. You are a good doggo. Go figure it out.
I got to play a princess pug, and I was the pugliest princess pug ever.
Alan, that's one of the most Alan sentences I've ever heard you utter.
Uh-huh. But again, taste is one thing, but another thing that I think is important to bring up with this is even if you were, because I noticed that you did put in there that, you know, you're not a part of the furry community, and that's fine. But we also want to make sure that there's no kink shaming here. You know, if that's your bag and that's what you want to do, go for it. More power to you. That is amazing. But I do feel it's like you said earlier, Matt, there's been a lot of unnecessary negative connotation placed on the furry community and that kind of thing that isn't deserved. So I do think that that colors the lens with which people look at games that they don't know that do focus on anthropomorphized animals.
Yeah. So I guess our actual thing is stand in your truth, chase your bliss. Mm-hmm. If someone's giving you shit about it, point us at them and we'll have words with them and try to help them not be assholes. Man, play whatever game you want. Have a rockin' good time.
Have fun. Go for it.
Tell us about your adventures as some like anthropomorphic fox person with a rifle. That sounds great.
Amazing.
Unseat the royalty and the patriarchy. Bring it down.
Smash the demon lizard patriarchy.
In that world, it might actually just be lizard people.
Oh, that would be so good.
It's okay. All right.
So
next question, Alan.
That Daria girl, or at dark skint Daria on Twitter, asks, what differentiates a good story idea and an actual playable game construct?
I have thoughts about this. And
thought you might.
It starts with one very solid rule that I learned while I was doing my master's and from following established authors on the Twitters and everything. Ideas are a dime a fucking dozen. You can have, man, in a day, I can spit you out anywhere from 3 to 12 story ideas. Ideas are cheap. A good playable game construct. And I think this is part of the fun of what we do here on the show, Alan. We take an idea and then we have to, like, I'm going to directly steal from the McElroys. And if any of the McElroy boys ever hear this, I apologize so much.
No, you don't.
But we take those ideas and turn them alchemy-like into gameplay. A good story idea is common and simple. Everyone has them. An actual playable game construct takes the ability to look at an idea, to break it apart, to analyze all of its pieces, to throw away everything from that that doesn't work, and then be able to slot it in to what you want this game to do.
I agree with an asterisk.
Okay.
And that asterisk is you also have to look at your story idea and then shatter it with a hammer.
Yeah.
And you have to think to yourself, okay, this, the difference between, in my opinion, a good story idea and a game construct, game constructs are living things, and they are not yours.
Yep.
They are, but they're not. You're the originator. You're the mother in this instance, but it takes a village. Your players shape the story just as much, if not more, than you do. You may have this general story idea, but if you start thinking about it and you're like, oh no, it has to be A, B, C, D, E, F, G, cool. That's a good story for a book. That is not necessarily a good story for a game, because it has to be interactable, and it has to allow for changes and deviations from whatever you think is quote-unquote supposed to happen. Because in a game, nothing is supposed to happen.
Yeah.
The players make the choices, and that's what happens.
Absolutely. I want to give you all an example of this. I'm sure Alan can too. So for me, I'm going to use one from Grayscale, the campaign I'm running over on Lost Library. In our latest episode, the one that, as of the day we're recording this, the third part just dropped. Go check it out. The Lost Library cast on Twitter. In this story, I had an idea of what the villain was, who he was, kind of what his whole deal is, and how he's tying into kind of the overall meta story that I'm using. And one of my players, Nora, declared something pretty early on. Like, in the first part, she declared something about this. I asked her a question, and she was just like, oh, well, this is the answer. And I was just like, oh, well, I mean, of course, yeah, it's that. Like, of course it is. It couldn't be anything else now that you've said it out loud, and not in a negative way. Like, when mm-hmm. she said it, it clicked. It was just like, oh, yeah, no, that's 100% what I was missing. But it also has caused me to, like, that one sentence that she uttered has rippled through everything I had planned for this game. Like, things that I had laid out, I was just like, oh, no. Like, and not in a bad way. It's a very good thing, because what it did was it took my established ideas and just kind of gave them one of those big, like, whoomp motions that you do to a blanket to get it to lay out on the bed straight. It did that, and it shook everything up, and I was able to see the pattern of it better, because she had shattered what I had been slowly letting crystallize in my head without giving it a chance to really evolve more.
And that can be the most dangerous part of crafting a game, is that you become married and beholden to the story in your head, that it must play out the way it's supposed to in your head. And we have all fallen for this trap.
Absolutely.
I don't think there is a game master out there that has not, in some ways, fallen for that. And you'll get mad at yourself when you realize that that it's happening to you. But in the moment, you won't realize it. And you'll just be like, no, this is what it needs to be. This is how this is what is supposed to happen. But the key is that you need to have everything be as loose as it can while still holding structure. Mm-hmm. The way I always describe it is, you need a skeleton. You need ligaments. You don't need muscles. You don't need skin. You don't need organs. All of that is going to come from your players. They're going to flesh everything out in both a literal and figurative sense here. But they're going to be the ones that really make your story come alive and be more than just I could write this as a book, and more, this is the kind of story that can only be told in a role-playing environment. And I think that's what makes games so captivating for so many people, whether they're tabletop or video or whatever, is that those type of interactable stories are so hard to replicate without a game format.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, this question is the reason the term railroading exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of hate that term, because it's bandied about a lot more than what it actually applies to. This is what it actually is a GM going, okay, you come up to a T section, and the GM's like, y'all are supposed to go right. And the player's like, no, I'm going to go left. And the GM just goes, no, you're going right.
I used to have, when I was in college and I played with a group, we would rotate. And one of the GMs, if we did something they didn't want, there would be a bunch of snakes. And so if we started to do something, it got to be such a joke. If we would say something and they didn't want us to do it, they would literally just go,
that's not okay.
And it wasn't fun. You know, and I guess it was good for them because they got to tell their story. But for the players, it's kind of a letdown because that makes all of their choices irrelevant. Well, they don't have any.
Yeah.
You know, and I've also heard bandied about, oh, give them the illusion of choice. And that kind of goes both ways. Yes, you can give them the illusion of choice, and whatever choice they make still leads to the decision you have made, which is fine. But at the same time, if there is no choice, there is no consequences. There is no reaction within the world itself against what the characters are doing.
The illusion of choice is fine if you're doing like a one-shot or a con game where you don't have time to explore what happens if your party goes left instead of going right. Like, if you need them to just get to the end of the dungeon, then if they choose to go right instead of left, then I'm just going to take my entire map, pick it up from the right-hand branch, and rotate it over to the left-hand branch. Problem solved.
Yep.
That's fine in one of those settings where it's like, I have a time crunch. I'm probably never going to see these people again. I'm just looking to give them a fun experience. They want to go that direction. Great. Let's go that direction. In a campaign, you really do have to give your players all those options. And we're getting way afield from like idea versus actual game construct. And we're about to get into some other conversations. So why don't we just refer back, like, a good idea in a game construct terms should have a good outline for what you want it to do, but not be so rigid that what your players do can't affect it.
Absolutely. Flexible, but still structured.
And you want to make sure that there are some good things that your players can cling on to.
And that you listen to your players.
Yes.
Because they may find something in your story that they like that you just kind of put in as a passing thought, but could allow you to grow. In the same kind of vein, she asks, looking back on the first game you've ever GM'd, what advice or words of wisdom would you have given tabletop noob you?
Oh, man. I can sum this up in one sentence.
Cool.
Hey, buddy, chill the fuck out.
Same.
Just be cool for 2 seconds, buddy.
Like, unclench that butthole. Like,
just relax.
It's okay. Roll with it. You know, you don't have to have eaten the entirety of the 3.5 Dungeon Master Guide, Player Handbook, and Monster Manual. The rules aren't that holy and that important. Just calm down. And I know that that can be very difficult because, actually, our next question has to do with nerves, so we'll kind of only touch on it a little bit here. But when you're first running that first game, it can be very tricky to thread that needle. And my biggest piece of advice is trust yourself. Trust the story that you have put together. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But have fun while doing it. Because if you get so, like, wound up in what you're trying to do, you lose the forest for the trees.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, just relax. Remember, and this is something that I have been having to repeat in my head over and over and over these last couple of weeks because of some local stuff that's going on. Man, chill out. It's D&D. This isn't, you know, life-shatteringly critical stuff. You're playing pretend with some, hopefully, friends of yours with dice and little plastic figures. This is not something to get worked up about.
The other thing that I would tell young me would be that your players are not judging you,
mm-hmm.
and that they are looking to you to guide them on an adventure. They want to have fun. If they are at the table, they want to have fun.
Yeah.
So just remember that the whole point is not just for you to have fun, but they to have fun and you to have fun together. And people do that in different ways. One thing that I will say that I've kept since I was a noob GM is I love making props. If I play in a physical game with you, I'm going to probably make some props. I'll make some scrolls. I'll bring like those flickering tea light candles that are LEDs. I'm the nerd that will bake bread beforehand and like put it out with some oil and herbs. I serve dinner during games. Like if I have them be at a tavern, I will serve them dinner. But that's just me. It's a way that I can kind of settle my nerves, but also bring them into the world that I'm trying to make by giving them more physical touchstones to that world.
I think we do need to move on, because this Portia's second question here and the one we're about to get into are very, very similar in this regard. So let's move on to our last question. It's from Tea with Dragons, at Tea with Dragons. She and Portia both live tweet our Grayscale episodes, and I love it. And it's great fun, because it kind of serves as like a touchstone for me on how I'm doing as a GM. So her question is, how do you get over nerves of running a game, and how do you know when you've prepared enough material?
You don't, and you don't. Did I do it? Did I win?
I disagree, but go ahead.
Okay, so in all seriousness, to me, cards on the table. I have, if you haven't figured it out by my Twitter, I have fairly severe anxiety problems. And games, though, are one thing that I will be anxious about, but I can actually turn that anxiety into something. And in the case of games, it's productivity. It's making those props. It's planning. It's writing things down. It's, you know, really diving into this story, into the world that I want to build and the story I want to tell. With that being said, I wasn't kidding when I really don't think there's a aha when you know that you've prepared enough material. Every person is different. I've known game masters to walk in totally blind to games, sit down and just go, cool, let's roll some dice. On the other hand, you have game masters that have literal notebooks upon notebooks upon notebooks of stat blocks and quotes and NPC names. And, you know, they get into very, very specific minutiae, but that's what works for them. A lot of it is kind of finding your groove. Most people are kind of in the middle. I like to have me a good Google Doc or a good notebook where I can just kind of write down my ideas, flesh them out a little bit, play with them in my head, go over different scenarios that could happen with them. But for me personally, at least, I never feel prepared enough, because your PCs are going to throw curveballs at you. But that is the beauty of gaming, and tabletop gaming in particular, is you have to think on your feet. Being a game master is an exercise in mental hopscotch. It's like playing Dance Dance Revolution, where you don't quite know the music. It's a feeling like no other, that you, when you kind of dig into it and you let yourself enjoy it, to me, it's a little bit addictive.
I'm on the kind of opposite end of this from Alan. Alan just said he knows GMs who can just walk into a situation and just be like, all right, I've got nothing planned, let's do this. That's kind of me. And more what I found is, if I want to be successful in just a casual game, that's how I have to do it. Like, if I overthink it, then I run the risk, because of my personality, of railroading, of getting very upset if people don't, or not very upset, but getting all like disconcerted if people don't go the exact way I'm expecting them to go. There's some looseness in there. Like, I have a couple of just kind of pre-written adventures that are almost more like guides. Like, I have some rough maps for them. I have some notes on what kind of enemies could be in this area and what
you
kind of numbers.
You have maps?
Yeah, I know. Shocking and horrifying. I know.
What?
But, like, at our local FLGS, friendly local game store, we have a weekly D&D night. I'm one of the DMs there. I rarely plan what I'm going to do. I give them some options of some kind of general, I give my players some options of some general themes. And because it's all just one shots, I just kind of wing it. I reskin a lot of things to be off of stat blocks that I know really well. And I just kind of run them through whatever kind of pops up, whatever seems to fit best with what this group is doing. Like, I had a group where I threw them at a pirate encampment, they split the party three ways. They started a mutiny. Then they started a counter-mutiny. And then they still managed to talk their way out of it after one of them got into gladiatorial combat and started a gladiator ring in the middle of the camp. Like, I could not have planned for that at all. Because, listen, as a DM, and especially as a Dungeons & Dragons DM, if I throw a situation that's like, go and find this captive person in a pirate encampment, I expect them to go, great, my sword is out, my shield is out, I'm going to walk in, my wizard's going to drop a fireball on them, and we're just going to murder him until we find the guy. Because D&D encourages murder hobos. We don't like to talk about it, but we all know it's true. So that's kind of where I'm at. Like, when it comes to nerves, the biggest thing I can say about nerves is exactly what I just kind of said to Porsche's question a second ago. It's just chill. You're playing D&D. Nothing hinges on this.
One of the other things that I like to tell myself, because it also, as humans, it is easy for us to compare ourselves to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You are not Matt Mercer.
Yep.
You are not Justin McElroy. You are not insert other game master of a show or a podcast or anything that you really, really like and you look up to. You're not that person. You're you. You tell stories in a unique and wonderful way that is wholly unique to you. Embrace that. Don't try to be someone you're not. Matt Mercer is a great person to look to for tips. He taught me some voice acting strategies for characters that I didn't even know I could do. But I'm not going to ever GM like Matt Mercer. I'm only going to be able to GM like Alan Sells.
This is huge, because here's the thing. The world already has a Griffin McElroy. And more to the point, the world has a Griffin McElroy who told the Adventure Zone Balance story already. The world already has a Matt Mercer. We don't need more. Maybe what we need is you with your story to tell and your voice. There's only one of you. Tell your story the best way you can. And, like, listen, the dirty little secret is if you have nerves about this, they're probably not going to go away. What they're probably going to do is you're going to learn to be like, okay, I'm about to go run a game. Or in my case, I'm about to sit down and run a podcast game for my friends, my cast members and friends and people. And like, I still get a little bit terrified of this idea. Like, full disclosure, I made one of my cast members on Grayscale almost have a hyperventilating panic attack because of some stuff that they and I talked about. Like, and that's now going to stick with me. Now, it's a good lesson because I know I need to be a little bit more attentive to how my players are reacting. I need to know that it's okay to be like, okay, stop. We need to all breathe and talk for a second. And now we can resume. But those nerves aren't going to go away. Instead, you're going to learn how to recognize them for what they are, because what those nerves are not is those nerves are not a sign that you can't do it.
Thank you. It is not weakness.
Yeah.
You recognize them. If anything, what I tell people is those nerves mean you care.
Yeah.
And that is so important, because that means that whatever you're doing that you're nervous about is important to you. And it's important that you get to play this game with your friends, or it's important to you that you tell a fun story. Focus on it like that. Not, I can't do this. Not, I am trash. But rather, I'm nervous that I get to run a game for my friends and I hope they like it.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, if they're your friends, they probably will.
It is also important to note, again, that DMing at a table with your friends, like just in your house around a kitchen table, is worlds different than GMing for a podcast.
Or for people that you've met online. Now, that's a caveat. If it's people like you talk to on Twitter regularly and like you're friends with online, that's one thing. But going to a forum and putting in LFG, looking for group, you know, and you're getting a bunch of internet randos,
that can be terrifying.
Totally different experiences.
It's and that also is true if you're going to run like a game at a convention, mm-hmm. where you have zero way of even kind of filtering who you're going to get. But like strangers and con games, sometimes in that one, like you just have to kind of just fortify up and get through it. I think anyone who's ever run one of those knows that. Like you could ask any of us, we'll probably agree that sometimes you just got to go. Like you just got to fortify, get through it, and be done. In a podcast game, things are a little bit different because you're not just telling a story with your friends in a casual setting. You're telling a story for an audience, and that's a different can of worms.
Yep.
Like you have to kind of know what's coming there a little bit more. I can't show up to a Grayscale recording without any idea what's going on. I can't do that. I cannot do that because that's going to be weird. It's not going to sound good. It's not going to fit in what the story we're telling to y'all is. I have to know some things. And that's where that advice we gave about being able to be flexible really comes in handy. Yeah, Alan, this has been fun.
This has been a lot of fun. You should send us more questions, listeners.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
We didn't even get any weird questions.
Yeah, these are all just like really on topic questions. I didn't have to defend my love of a hedgehog Pokemon. So, you know, maybe take advantage next time a little bit. Make us dance for your amusement. Actually, please don't. I can't dance.
Ooh, do it. It'll be funny.
Well, this is an audio medium, so as far as the listeners know, I am perfect and amazing at everything.
Fair.
But, yeah, we're going to definitely do this again at some point. We'll probably wait a while again. But we're going to be back next week? Next week. Oh, Alan and I both just realized that we don't really have a break in between these two. Oops. Whatever.
Next week for a brand new world. So please, before we usually record Forging Worlds on Monday evenings. So if you want to get in some suggestions that we could put on the list for before we roll or anything like that, please, please, please do that before Sunday at midnight. That's when we'll look and we'll just kind of cut it off then. And we'll add everything to the list so it'll be ready when we sit down to kind of roll on the table.
And then we'll roll it up, we'll record it, and we'll start in on another four-episode world. It's going to be great.
Yep.
All right. Well, Ben, I guess the next time, I'm Matt.
And I'm Alan.
For John.
You can find Alan at Alan_Sells on Twitter. You can find Matt at Matt Hoadley on Twitter. You can reach the show at Forging_Worlds, or by emailing us, ForgingWorlds@FifthDraw.com. This show and the rest of the Fifth Draw family of shows can be found at FifthDraw.com. Forging Worlds is presented under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.